EU leaders are struggling to tackle soaring gas and electricity prices as energy poverty threatens millions across the bloc. A new study shows only 5% of Britons believe that their politicians are working for the public good. And the death toll from a volcanic eruption on Indonesia's Java Island is rising. I'm Behrouz Najafi. Welcome. Now, experts are warning that energy poverty could impact up to 80 million people in the European Union before the end of winter. And that's why the bloc's leaders are struggling to agree to a coordinated approach to address rising gas and electricity prices. Jerome Hughes reports from Brussels.
The European Commission's Joint Research Centre says 50 million people in the EU are suffering the effects of so-called energy poverty. It means households are having to prioritise food over heat. EU energy ministers have been meeting in Brussels to assess the crisis.
Since we launched our communication and toolbox on energy prices, 20 member states have taken or announced measures to mitigate the impact on their people and businesses, in particular the most vulnerable.
But that means almost a third of EU governments have not taken any action to protect citizens. Gas and electricity prices are out of control. Civil society organisations are forecasting that energy poverty will be hitting 80 million people in the EU before winter is over.
My invoice, energy invoice, has gone up from 70 to 110. That's a lot. The inflation has gone up. Families are struggling.
The second question is, of course, to know what the EU is doing at the EU level, you know, to handle the situation. And they have a responsibility, and there is a lack of political will for the moment by the politicians, I believe, to do something about it.
The EU's dysfunctional energy market is currently in a state of flux. The bloc is heavily dependent on Russia's gas. The European Commission confirms Moscow is fulfilling all of its supply contracts. However, energy storage is a problem in the EU. Supplies were depleted last winter due to unusually cold weather. Then there was huge demand when EU nations began lifting COVID-19 restrictions. Energy experts say the EU could benefit if it improved relations with Russia. The 27-country bloc could also push back against US foreign policy so that new supply chains could be utilised, for example, with respect to Iran, which has enormous energy reserves. EU leaders are divided over how to deal with the crisis, but it's clear there are no quick fixes. The matter will be high on their agenda when they meet here in just under 2 weeks' time for a summit on the 16th of December. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
All right, now time for the news review section. Now, surveys have revealed that there has been a gradual decline in public trust in British politicians across decades, and that's to the point where it's close to non-existent today. A recent poll suggesting that only 5% of Britons believe that politicians are working for public good rather than for themselves. The survey also suggests that faith in UK statesmen has dropped sharply since Boris Johnson took office as Prime Minister. The distress is partly because of concerns over the UK struggling to re-establish its economic and diplomatic alliances after the Brexit. The government's handling of the COVID pandemic is another reason for the decline in public trust, and British politicians' involvement in an array of scandals is also being partly blamed. Johnson's government has been mired in sleaze claims after it tried to save Conservative MP Owen Paterson from suspension last month. Two people will be joining me now to discuss this a little bit. So we have Robert Carter, a correspondent in London. Also, I'm joined by Marcus Papadopoulos, historian and political analyst and author in London, too. Good to have you both on the show. Robert, so
public trust. It's a really invaluable asset that looks like to have been lost in the UK. Tell us more about the reasons contributing to this.
Well, there is more than one scandal which has plagued the ruling Tory government over the past weeks. The latest one is, of course, talk about apparent parties that were taking place in No. 10 Downing Street during the lockdown last year. So whilst everyone else was expected to stay at home and celebratory occasions such as Eid for Muslims, being able to go and pray in the mosque, even going to your own family member's home for anyone, those were being restricted whilst politicians basically had their own set of rules and were engaging in parties, mixing and so on, totally enjoying themselves while everyone else was struggling, it seems. That's just one of many. I think also what's affecting public trust in the ruling establishment as well is the fact that politicians are considered to be a bunch of liars, to be quite frank with you. That hasn't been helped by the fact that Brexit hasn't quite gone the way that many would have hoped. Many of the promises that Boris Johnson has been on record as saying he would commit to should Brexit be fulfilled and he became Prime Minister, many of those promises are not actually being fulfilled as they said that they were. So there is major issues which aren't being helped. And I think that another sign of growing distrust in the authorities is the quite large scale distrust of how the country is dealing with the COVID outbreak. I think that many people are surprised by just how many people as well don't trust the establishment. They don't trust the vaccine rollout. They don't trust what politicians are telling them about the outbreak. They don't trust the numbers that are being revealed. Some people don't even believe that there is such a thing as COVID. And I think that this has, by and large, been peddled by conspiracy theorists, but there are far too many what you might call ordinary voters which are believing those ideals and those comments more than what they're hearing from No. 10 Downing Street. So it's a long line of things. The opposition as well are trying to capitalise on it now, particularly the Labour Party, which looks set to keep challenging Boris Johnson on his sleaze and scandals. Mm-hmm. But again, even opposition parties are not particularly well trusted, I believe, among large sections of the British electorate.
Okay. Now, let me ask Marcus Papadopoulos. Marcus, this distrust, as it is reported, and I just announced it in the intro, Boris Johnson has a big role in that. It's sharply declined after he took the helm as Prime Minister. Let's talk about how big an effect Boris Johnson has in this and what could be the consequences of this loss of public trust among the Britons.
Well, I am a member of the Parliamentary Press Gallery at Westminster, hence I have particular insight on this matter. And it is suffice to say that for many years now, I have argued that members of Parliament at Westminster constitute a microcosm of how British society as a whole has rapidly deteriorated and is continuing to deteriorate. Because the calibre of MPs across the House of Commons is atrociously low. It is particularly bad on the Labour benches, but as I said, it is pervasive. It is particularly bad on the Conservative benches, and it is particularly bad on the Liberal Democrats benches, but as I said, when it comes to Labour MPs, it is even worse. So, the intelligence levels of MPs is appallingly and shockingly low. The work ethic of MPs is disgraceful. The knowledge of Britain and the wider world of MPs is limited to Wikipedia. Their life experiences is almost confined to university. That is the core reason as to why there is very little trust amongst the British public in their elected representatives at Westminster. So let me give you some examples. We have one MP who feels it's totally appropriate to take her newly born baby into the House of Commons, into the chamber. We have other MPs MPs who believe it is perfectly appropriate to wear trainers in the House of Commons. There is another MP who was recently convicted of threatening to throw acid in another person's face. And not so long ago, it was revealed that the son of one MP was charged and found guilty of being in possession of a Class A drug with the intention to sell this Class A drug. So it's not just about Boris Johnson. The standards in the House of Commons, in the chamber, have been deteriorating for the last 20 years or so. And I should add as well that the standards of the average Briton are no different to the standards of the average MP at Westminster. Because the average Briton, instead of being interested in how civil liberties are being eroded in Britain under the cover of COVID-19, instead of being interested in how there are 14 million Britons living in poverty, how there are 4 million children living below the breadline, the average Briton is more interested in which celebrities are having extramarital affairs and which celebrities have had new teeth placed in their mouths. So the situation at Parliament is representative of the situation in Britain as a whole.
Okay, thank you very much for that. Robert Carter, our correspondent, and Marcus Papadopoulos, historian, political analyst, and author, joined us from London. Now moving on, many Europeans are angry against restrictions enforced by their governments to curb a resurgence of the COVID pandemic, and they've demonstrated in several cities to make their voices heard. In Denmark, tens of thousands marched through the streets of Copenhagen to show their anger at the restrictions. The country has reintroduced mandatory face coverings in some places. Similar demonstrations were held in Vienna. Last month, Austria became the first in Western Europe to reimpose a national lockdown. It also is planning to make vaccinations compulsory from February. In Spain, thousands gathered in Barcelona against COVID vaccine passes that are now required to enter restaurants, gyms, and care homes. And a march was also held in the Dutch city of Utrecht. Violent protests broke out in the Netherlands 3 weeks ago, shortly after the government announced a lockdown there. Now, France's yellow vests have become a worldwide phenomenon, but they've repeatedly accused their own domestic media of refusing to cover their marches. During the latest nationwide demonstration, a yellow vest group targeted government media headquarters to accuse them of not fulfilling their duty to taxpayers. Rami Mazahara reports from Paris.
If the yellow vests march, but the mainstream media doesn't cover it, does it have an effect? In the age of social media, the answer seems to be an unequivocal yes, perhaps much to the anger of so-called legacy media. Since the yellow vests started their season two, domestic media has been almost completely absent. But for the eighth consecutive Saturday, they marched nationwide, shut down toll booths, and occupied roundabouts. The yellow vests say they don't expect fair treatment from France's private media. Less than 10 billionaires control 90% of all the nation's media, with strict control over an editorial policy which many say is often right-wing.
Starting in June 2019, France's mainstream media simply stopped reporting on the yellow vests. However, they continued to march nationwide in major numbers through the two-month general strike that winter and until March 2020, when the coronavirus forced a ban on all public demonstrations.
It seems the only thing which will get mainstream journalists to turn away from their oligarchical bosses is fear. Their reports aim to make the entire population afraid and to deny us our freedoms and human rights. But if we return to being hundreds of thousands or millions of yellow vests in the street, then maybe we can force them to finally switch sides.
In Paris, one of the yellow vest demonstrations gathered outside of government-owned Radio France's headquarters to denounce the failure of public media journalists to provide fair coverage of the nation's biggest social movement in decades.
We pay our taxes to support public media, and we pay to help privately owned media as well, but they both relay the exact same opinions and both exclude them. They both slander any dissenting voices. What we're asking for is that the diversity of opinions be respected, and we're telling these journalists to stop their censorship and propaganda.
The ever-increasing concentration of French media ownership has forced the government to act. This week, they quietly authorized a commission to investigate the issue, with results due in early 2022. The conclusions will likely have a lot to say about the true freedom of the French press during the age of Western corporate domination. Rami Mazahiri, Paris.
The death toll from a sudden volcanic activity on Indonesia's Java Island has climbed to at least 13. Mount Semeru, Java's biggest mountain, roared into life again on Saturday, forcing thousands to flee in panic. Thick smoke and ashes spewed from the volcano, darkening the skies and submerging homes. Authorities say almost 100 people were injured while trying to run for their lives. Rescuers searching nearby villages for survivors. Some 1,000 residents have been evacuated to safety. They're being accommodated in mosques, schools, and village halls. Semeru is one of Indonesia's nearly 130 active volcanoes. It erupted earlier this year but caused no casualties. Well, that's all for this broadcast.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Aperture. Welcome back, everyone. In the first part, we saw how in 1951, inhabitants of a French village were suddenly tormented by terrifying hallucinations. At least seven people died, dozens were taken to a local asylum, and hundreds were affected. Immediately, wild theories started emerging to explain this mysterious case of mass insanity. There were claims of poisoned flour, contaminated water, and even witchcraft. The truth was stranger than any of these theories. The Central Intelligence Agency had spiked the local food with LSD as part of a mind control experiment at the height of the Cold War. And with time, U.S. government's interest in LSD shifted from a defensive to an offensive orientation. While the initial experiments with LSD were fairly simple, if shockingly unethical, over time these LSD experiments grew increasingly elaborate. Stay with us as victims reveal the naked truth in the next part of this program.
Entire populations bore the consequence of large-scale tests. Here are some examples. Again, uncontested cases that are recognized by the American government. In 1953, radioactive iodine was injected into newborns and pregnant women at Iowa University and also in Nebraska. In 1955, the CIA sprayed whooping cough bacteria off the coast of Tampa. Two died, and dozens fell ill. Also in 1955, the CIA enlisted prostitutes in San Francisco, opened two brothels and tested drugs on the clients, then filmed through a one-way mirror. In 1956, the Army released millions of mosquitoes carrying yellow fever and dengue on the towns of Savannah and Avon. There were several deaths and hundreds of people infected. In 1960, in Cincinnati, the Army financed a radiation program on 90 destitute or ill inhabitants of the city's University Hospital. Some died after several weeks. In 1966, the Army tested a virus in the New York Metro, then in Chicago. The bacteria was concealed in electric bulbs. The aim was to study the spread of chemical agents on a large scale. For these experiments, the Army or the CIA funded laboratories in the most prestigious universities: Yale, Stanford, Harvard, or Columbia. They all took part. Glorified by the idea of working for the nation's defense, the researchers went crazy.
Dr. Kligman in Philadelphia increases a dosage 468 times, which actually frightened Dow Chemical. They couldn't believe that a respected doctor would do that. In Washington, D.C., you had Walter Freeman, who was a very, very well-known lobotomist who traveled around the country doing lobotomies in his car, and he would use an ice pick. He could do 15 to 20 in a day. It was just incredible what some doctors did. And very few, if any, people in the hospital or the medical community blew the whistle on it. It really was an egregious act, and it showed that the medical community was more interested in protecting its ass than in protecting the test subject and the patients, because a lot of doctors went off the deep end and started doing things that are just inconceivable now.
To express his indignation, Alan Hornblum wrote half a dozen books. A former prison guard at Holmesburg in Pennsylvania, from his first day at work over 40 years ago, he had a horrible shock.
I was stunned to see scores of inmates with their shirts off, strapped and wrapped in bandages and gauze tape. And I couldn't imagine that I was going into an atmosphere that was that violent, because all of the men looked like they had just walked a cell block knife fight.
They explain that it's not because of any violence, but experiments that are carried out there. Alan was the first to denounce this scandal and would lose his job as a result.
It was probably the largest human experimentation factory in America, possibly the world. From 51 until 1974, more people were probably incorporated in more experiments than any other place in the world.
Drugs, viruses, cancerous cells, plutonium, sarin gas, the most toxic products were tested in Holmesburg, but also in dozens of prisons throughout the country. To condemn these experiments, Alan Hornblum found former inmates like Youssef. In 1961, this man was imprisoned for selling marijuana. He was poor, with limited education. He was offered a chance to take part in tests for $1 a day. Since then, Yusuf has had his digestive tract operated on. He has liver and skin problems and can no longer work. His first test was for a bath foam from the company Johnson & Johnson.
They took tape and they stuck it on your back and pulled it off, stuck it on and pulled it off until the first layer of skin came off your back. And they put six sections on my back like that. And then they took a bottle with the Johnson & Johnson bubble bath in it and put it on a patch and put the patch over the raw area. Then they took a can. I recognized that can as being from the Army. And I was like, what Johnson & Johnson got to do with this? So he took the can and he sprayed it on my back. And when it hit my back, it was cold. But it was so toxic and like fumes, I could taste it in my mouth. And as I'm walking down, I'm getting dizzier and dizzier, dizzier and dizzier. By the time I stepped into my cell, I passed out. Boom, and my back was inflamed. And by the time I woke up that morning, I had great big blisters on my back full of pus. This rash just gets worse and worse. And it looks like when the moon come out at night, it flames up and I'll be moaning and crying and moaning and crying. My cell partners couldn't sleep. We goes over there, a little shot cup, and it looked like water. We drinks it. Everything became magnified. The sound, like the loudspeaker on the system. Ooh, ooh, ooh. The walls look like they turned into water. You know what I mean? And like I spent the whole time like looking around like this here instead of doing the test. So I goes back to the block in that condition. And man, I mean, I was tripping. And it was like a slow acting drug that was in that cup. It lasts for weeks. The inmates start naming me Outer Limits. I had no conversation for nobody. I was scared of the inmates, and the inmates act like they was afraid of me.
What you had were hundreds and hundreds of uneducated minorities, overwhelmingly black and Puerto Rican, and then you had white doctors with white lab coats with PhD or MD after their name, and it was a recipe for abuse, if not disaster. And those prison walls are an ideal spot to do controversial experiments, because just as those walls keep the inmates in, they also keep the public out, so no one finds out about it.
Prisoners were used, but also patients. In certain hospitals, patients were steered towards the services financed by the CIA. These services carried out limitless experiments on psychological manipulation. In 1965, Karen Wetmore was only 13 when she was admitted to a hospital in Vermont. She stayed there several times in her childhood. She suffered from severe depression after falling victim to a pedophile neighbor. Admitted against her will, she was not allowed any contact with her family, being told that it was for her own good.
The CIA was specifically looking for children between the ages of 13 and 18 to further dissociate. They wanted dissociative children. There's a sense of absolute and total helplessness. You're there, you're bound up, you're locked in this room. No matter how you scream, no matter what you say, no one is going to come. It does something to you, something you don't get over.
The doctors went to work on Karen. They wanted to erase her memory and create a robot at their command. It took 30 years of legal battles for Karen to obtain her medical records and discover the violence of the treatments she was subjected to.
It says seclusion, full cam. A cam is a straitjacket. And ties, which means they tied my arms and they tied my feet. This goes on uninterrupted, day after day, week after week, February, March, April, right up until June 21st, 1971, you sleep on the floor. On the floor. No blanket, no nothing. And my arms were secured like this, behind my back. I do remember that. It's extremely painful because it pulls on your neck, pulls on your shoulder. You can't get away from it. It's maddening is what it is. Maddening. And I was naked. And I think that was part of the effort of that experiment to break me down. Everything they did was to break me down.
Months in a confined room with no bearings, while her captors administered all kinds of drugs and sometimes electric shocks at inhuman levels.
Number of shocks and the seconds that they held the shocks. They had 30, 30, 35, 35, 35, and they held it for sustained for 40 seconds. A normal shock would be a second. Certainly not 30 and 35 of them. One, not that many, which probably is what obliterated my memory right there. And I think that's the way they did it. They also said, in this treatment right here, no seizure, shock restarted, so they gave me a second one because they couldn't produce a seizure. So they must have done it over again, must have repeated it. It's unforgivable. And I'm sure I wasn't the only one they did this to, I'm sure. I survived to be able to talk about it.
How many suffered similar experiments? In Montreal, Canada, the CIA used a world-renowned psychiatrist to set up a factory of guinea pigs in the Allen Memorial Psychiatric Department in McGill University. This psychiatrist was Ewan Cameron, one of the all-powerful presidents of the World Psychiatric Association. In 1945, Ewan Cameron made the acquaintance of Rudolf Hess, one of the Nazis accused in the Nuremberg trial. In 1957, the CIA recruited him for their MK-Ultra program. The Americans wanted to perfect their interrogation techniques and program a human to kill. Ewan Cameron became the mad dog of psychiatry. He put his patients in vegetative states for several weeks while bombarding them with pre-recorded orders. Some would become incontinent, amnesiac, forgetting even who their parents were and how to speak. The Vermont hospital where Karen Wetmore was confined was working on the same program. In the hands of the CIA doctors, she was like a rag doll.
They used drugs like LSD. They used electric shock. They used chemical shock agent metrazole, which I was given in 1971. And I found that out in my medical records, which is a very brutal drug, very brutal drug. CIA said it was excruciating. Physically and emotionally, excruciating drug. I have a quote from the CIA that said that the Soviets used it in the gulags, and that a POW would say or do anything to avoid a second dose. Nice drug.
There's all kinds of people who believe and people who don't believe, and that's a debate about do you believe or don't believe. I'm always interested in what are in the documents saying. So the documents clearly describe implanting electrodes in people's brains, activating the electrode from a remote transmitter, and changing the person's behavior from angry, pounding the wall, sitting there just staring.
Behind Karen's ear is a scar, and she doesn't know what it's from.
Once my therapist really understood that I had really been experimented on by the CIA, she said to me, just for the heck of it, let me look. Because we'd read about, there's been information about these implants. And I'm like, okay. And it was there. I showed you. I went to a plastic surgeon who told me it was a surgical scar. But there's nothing in my medical history, nothing in a medical record that shows any kind of problem ever behind my right ear, or any incision or any surgery or anything else. But there it is.
What stopped the journey down this destructive path? In 1973, while Watergate is rattling all the institutions, Richard Helms, director of the CIA, feels the winds of change. He works as a lone wolf and hasn't informed the president of these experiments. He knows he's crossed the line. To protect himself, he orders the destruction of all documents relating to the MKUltra program and its abandonment. 2 years later, in 1975, the President Gerald Ford orders an inquiry into the CIA. The Rockefeller Commission is sworn in. The task isn't simple, because at the heart of the CIA, even Richard Helms' close lieutenants know nothing about the brainwashing programs.
There's a lot of goofy things that go on in a big agency like that with all that secrecy. Things can go on that you don't know about, that the people who are working for the director most closely don't know about, or that the director doesn't know about. I mean, they're keeping it quiet down there. You don't tell anybody. If it works, then we'll tell them. But, you know, in the meantime, don't get into any difficulties. I remember when they wanted to take a kitty cat and stick a microphone up its rear end and put an antenna on its ear and have him walk in where we spy in the park with another one, walk over and walk around and listen in on it. You know, they tried it one time in an experiment, and a taxi came by and ran over the cat. You know, so.
In reality, nothing is funny. In its haste to get rid of evidence, the CIA forgets 20,000 documents. A drop of water compared to the amount that was destroyed, but they reveal that it financed 149 programs, implicating 80 institutions, including the most respected. Called on to justify themselves, the heads of the CIA, like Dr. Lashbrook, lie and downplay the facts.
There was, of course, claims or thoughts that maybe great things could be done with hypnosis. One small project in which we had a hypnotist do some experiments, primarily to see what the limitations of hypnosis might be. Can you make a person do something under hypnosis that he would not ordinarily do?
Even if the head of the CIA, Richard Helms, tried to minimize the scale of the experiments, the victims' testimonies contradict him.
The next thing I remember,
the inquiry commissions follow, each reaching more and more witnesses, like this woman, Chris DeNicola. Her father put her in the hands of a reputed CIA doctor, Dr. Green, when she was 12 years old.
His objective was to gain control of my mind and train me to be a spy assassin. Dr. Green had electrodes on my body, including my head. He used what looked like an overhead projector and repeatedly said he was burning different images into my brain while a red light flashed aimed at my forehead. In between each sequence, he used electric shock on my body and told me to go deeper and deeper, while repeating each image would go deeper into my brain and I would do whatever he told me to do. Dr. Green moved on to wanting me to kill dolls that looked like real children.
Inquiry reports that resulted from these terrifying testimonies revealed one thing for certain. The experiments ended in disaster. In its insane quest for a robot human or a truth serum, the CIA failed. On August 3rd, 1995, with the revelations mounting up, then-President Bill Clinton makes a public apology. Since then, a great number of secret archives have been released to the public domain. Researchers would take an interest in this troubled period, notably Hank Alberelli, who worked on the suspicious death of Frank Olson, the biochemist who worked at the heart of the CIA. Since 1951, the year of the Pont Saint-Esprit incident, Frank Olson called into question the ethics of the experiments being carried out and became depressed as a result. In November 1953, the CIA put LSD into his glass without him knowing. 9 days later, he threw himself off the 13th floor of a New York hotel. Murder or suicide, we'll never know. At the time of the investigation, Hank Alberelli found a surprising document coming from the White House. It surprisingly linked the name of Frank Olson to Pont Saint-Esprit. Why, in the middle of the Korean War, would the White House be interested in this small French village? Even better, Hank also came across a study carried out by the CIA on LSD.
The document itself was a comprehensive overview or history, if you will, of LSD specifically, yes. Not on ergot. It had nothing to do with ergot. There was a section or chapter, if you will, headed incident at Pont Saint-Esprit. And the first two paragraphs of that describe essentially what we've all read, you know, many times over in terms of what happened at Pont Saint-Esprit. But the remainder of that section, the rest of that page, which was about half the page, and the two pages that followed, were completely blacked out.
Above all was this damning document from the CIA. It dates from 1953 and has no doubt been declassified by mistake. A director at Sandoz Laboratories confirmed to a secret agent that the Pont Saint-Esprit incident was caused by LSD. Sandoz Laboratories was where Albert Hoffman worked, the man who discovered LSD. It even claimed the drug was responsible for the Pont Saint-Esprit tragedy, before recanting. This same document states that in 1952, the source at the CIA had already explained that the cursed bread was caused by LSD. Did French authorities try to silence the affair? Several years after the drama, a head of the Victims Association was shocked at how disinterested the investigators were. Do the French have something to hide? We've interrogated former members of the Secret Services, investigated national and regional archives, as well as those from the police and the Justice Department. The files are hard to find, and many important pieces, such as reports from main hearings, have disappeared. If America revealed unwillingly some of its secrets about its participation in the poisoning, the uncertainties over the involvement of the French authorities may yet go on for some years longer. It takes 75 years for some sensitive documents to be made public. Hidden in its small streets and stone buildings, Le Pont Saint-Esprit drama has yet to reveal all its secrets.
Judging from the CIA's dark and notorious past of misconduct, perhaps it'll be no surprise if horrific clandestine high-tech experiments are being carried out somewhere in the world by the CIA at this very moment. Secrets that we must wait 75 years to be declassified, if ever disclosed to the public at all. And that's everyone for this week on Aperture. It's goodbye.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Stories from the past.
Stories from the lives of the infallibles. Stories from different parts of the world. On the Lantern.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Thank you so very much for joining us on today's brand new episode of The Lantern. There's a very interesting hadith from Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali alayhi salam, where His Eminence says, "The value of a man is in the measure of his effort." There's a lot to be said about this hadith. There's a lot we can understand and learn from it. But just for us to get a proper idea about what we are talking about regarding a human's value, let's listen to today's short anecdote, and we're going to be right back, so stay with us.
A well-known speaker started his seminar by holding up a brand new $20 bill. In the room filled with people, he asked if anyone would like to have this $20 bill. Hands in the rooms started going up. He crumpled and crumbled the bill and asked the crowd if anyone was still interested to have the bill. The hands were still up, signing that people still wanted to crumple $20 bill. He then dropped the bill on the ground and started to grind it into the floor with his shoe. He picked up, now crumbled, and dirty $20 bill. "Does anyone still want the bill?" he asked. Still, the hands went into the air. The speaker said, "Today we have all learned a valuable lesson. No matter what I did to the bill, you still wanted it, because it did not lose its value." Many times in our lives, we are dropped, crumbled, and ground into the dirt by decisions we make and the circumstances that come our way. We may feel as we are worthless, but no matter what happen or what will happen, you will never lose your value. Now, what's the moral of the story? Dirty or clean, crumbled or creased? We are priceless. The worth of our lives comes from not in what we do or who we know, but by who we are.
The Lantern.
Under the light of lantern, we'll look at the story which indicates a moral aspects of our life.
If I am willing to invest my energy into acquiring knowledge, if I am willing to invest my energy in charity work, if I am willing to invest my energy in, you know, gaining more votes, becoming famous and powerful, if I am willing to invest my energy in serving others through the platform that I've earned, if I am willing to invest my energy in building a family, raising children that can contribute to humanity and make Imam Zaman proud, does that not define my value? What I am willing to spend myself in, the path I'm willing to live my life, my days, my hours in until I die, I'd say that pretty much defines who I am, defines my worth. We are only worth what we want. I am not sure at this very moment whether that's a quote or a hadith, but, you know, in any case, some great thinker said it. We're worth what we want. If we strive for the hereafter, that's what we're worth. If we strive for this world that will last, well, there's no guarantee to how long it will last. It could last 85 years, it could last 85 days, it could last 8.5 minutes. But if that's all I look at, focus on, that's all I want to achieve, then that's all I'll live up to. That's all I will be. And that is sometimes a very scary thought. Because we are so enmeshed, we are so occupied in living our lives day to day. You know, sometimes to no fault of our own, we're just trying to make ends meet and survive because, I don't know, the economy is horrible, or we're being oppressed, or our rights are taken away from us, or, you know, the system wants it this way, or capitalism, or whatever. But in any case, we're so occupied in just making it, in getting by, in making it through and surviving, that we turn into such trivial, insignificant creatures. I'm not saying that it's everyone's responsibility to save the world, and we don't need to have some sort of, you know, I'm the savior complex. But at least we should be the protagonist of our own movie, the main character, to do something that will serve the entire plan of saving the world. We should do our own part in helping the cause of Allah. That should be our end goal. Even if our life is not the extraordinary type of, I don't know, Imam Khomeini or Imam Musa Sadr or Shahid Muhammad Baqir Sadr or, you know, people like that. But we still have to do our own part. We still have to do whatever we can to serve that bigger picture. And by doing so, defining our value. Come Yawm al-Qiyamah, and Allah asks us, what did you spend your life doing? Which they will ask. There are hadith that tell us we will be asked about our youth, our wealth, our health, our time, and our life in general. What are we going to answer? I spend my life doing a 9-to-5 job, and, you know, taking my family on vacation once a year, and, I don't know, grocery shopping, and watching news, and scrolling through Instagram and TikTok and YouTube. Maybe a few lectures once a year during Muharram and Safar. Really? Is that the kind of image I want to flash before my eyes during my final hours? There's more that we can do. Simply by making the active intention of investing our time and energy into more than this. One act of continuous kindness a month, but do it through your entire life with the intention of gaining Allah's satisfaction and making the world a better place in order to create the groundwork for Imam Zaman's reappearance. You'd be serving Duhur, and that would be your value. Thank you for being with us. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
That was all for today. Thank you very much for joining us. Inshallah, we continue this topic on the next episode. Till then, may Allah bless all of you. Fi amanillah. Ala bi dhikrillahi tatma'innu.
what you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.